This is the crisis point. Welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like Chesterton, we never discuss anything except politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I'm Michael Warren Davis, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Lawler, the director of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing just fine. Good. I'm reminded that I was once the editor of Crisis Magazine.
Were you really?
I was.
Phil is also, as of today, a contributing editor at Crisis Magazine. And I mean, he has more titles than I could possibly list, but I'm sure that he's well known to all of our listeners. So we're going to jump right into our first topic, which is the coronavirus pandemic, which is a topic that no one has really been talking about lately. So we should have plenty of fresh, original insights into this sort of obscure phenomenon. So, Phil, I was really enjoying the article that your most recent column at Catholic Culture, where you talk about the pastoral cost of the lockdown and how enormous it will be. I think that that's, even in a lot of Catholic circles, we're still paying attention mostly to the government, and rightly so, and we'll get into that. But I think that especially as Roman Catholics, we have to be concerned about the impact that this will have on the faith of ordinary men and women, which I think you're right, is going to be titanic.
I think it will be, yeah, I'm afraid it will be catastrophic. There are just sort of human nature reasons why I worry about it. When you tell people you don't have to go to church on Sunday, and you keep telling them that over a period of a couple of months, it does sink in. and they will, if human nature hasn't changed, they will assume, oh, that means we don't have to go to church on Sunday, because that's what you're telling them. And then time passes, and eventually you tell them, okay, now we are once again obligated to go to church on Sunday. And there's that moment where they say, well, do I want to follow that order or not? And I feel sure a lot will decide in the negative.
Absolutely. I was talking to someone who, I'm going to be as vague as possible, someone who works in the office of a bishop. And this gentleman was saying, I went into the office the other day, and one of the secretaries that also works in the bishop's office was said to me, you know, isn't it great that we get to watch mass over television now? Because, you know, when right. I get bored, I can just change the channel. If I don't like the sermon, I just switch to Jerry Springer, and then I come back for the consecration of the Eucharist. And this is someone that actually works for the church. I think that coming from, you know, people who tend to read things like Crisis Magazine tend to be rather devout, church going, which is terrific. But I think that sometimes we forget just how, you know, on the outside of our own circles, I mean, this really could be a catastrophe. This could be the biggest impetus to sort of mass unchurching that we've seen in the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, look at it this way. We already have, before this all began, before the epidemic, we had really horrendous demographic change in the church. Young people like yourself, not like me, leaving. The chances that someone who's raised as a Catholic will continue as a Catholic through adulthood are going down steadily as a percentage year to year. Okay, so that's one demographic. The other demographic is the older people who are or have been more likely to go to Mass on a regular basis. And they're being told, these are the people my age, they're being told you should probably stay home. And that's likely to continue for a good long while. And the older you get, the more worried you are about your health, the more likely you are to make excuses for yourself. And now add to that that for the last several weeks, we have been told, gee, you don't have to worry about getting to Mass. You can always watch a live stream. We're almost being told that's just as good. Well, it isn't. And the live stream Mass, I think, has issues of its own. One of the issues is, if you're going to watch Mass on the internet or on TV, there's no particular reason to watch the Mass from your own parish. Mm. So you're detached from the pastoral, from the community of faith. And it now becomes more of choose your own, which isn't, that's not a Catholic sensibility.
I admit that I was doing the same thing. Because I don't have a Facebook account, I couldn't watch my parishes because they were only streaming it over. And I started watching the fraternity Mass in Florida somewhere. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I mean, obviously, I can't wait to get back to an actual Mass. But yeah, I mean, even I'm totally guilty of that. I wasn't staying connected. I wasn't even keeping the slightest, most tenuous connection to my parish's liturgical life. Absolutely. And what's frightening, especially, is that if they say to themselves, you know, the bishop really cares about my health. He doesn't want me to come to Mass if I'm going to risk getting sick. I should probably stay home. I'm getting older. I'm kind of frail. My immune system isn't what it should be. There is technically an actual dispensation that if you're quote unquote, you know, unable to get to Mass, if it would pose a serious threat to your health. Am I wrong about this? There, you actually could. I don't think it would. I mean, it's a very limited dispensation, but you could almost see people using that to justify them just not wanting to go to Mass, wanting to stay at home and keep live streaming the Mass on EWTN TV.
Sure, that is a problem. And the problem with the dispensation is aggravated by the fact that a lot of bishops, when they announced that there would no longer be Mass for the public in their diocese, did not say that you are dispensed from your obligation. Now, you can easily figure it out for yourself that you're never required to do the impossible. And if there is no way to get to Mass, well, then of course you're dispensed from your obligation to get to Mass. But it would have been much better if the bishop had sent that message that you are dispensed, that this is not simply a matter of your deciding it's inconvenient or it's a little bit of a risk. And it's, let's face it, it's always going to be some degree of risk. I mean, most of us get in the car to go to Mass. There are people killed in accidents. You know, there's always some degree of risk in everything you do.
A lot of people made comparisons to the Spanish flu outbreak and the measures that bishops were taking during the Spanish flu. But what a lot of bishops did was, you know, when the government even forbade Masses, the bishops would not order priests to stop celebrating Masses. They would dispense the faithful. They would say, you're not obligated to go to Mass. You're not obligated to break the law. But the government doesn't have the right to make this law. And so you don't have an obligation to obey. The government doesn't have the right to suppress Holy Mass. These comparisons always seem kind of a little bit flip, and they irritate a lot of people. I know that there were a lot of conservative Christians who have taken the COVID pandemic as an excuse to virtue signal. And I can't stand all this talk about, you know, the real pro-lifers are the ones that want to indefinitely suspend public Masses and not receive our Lord in the Eucharist and things like that. That's what real Christians would do. That annoys the heck out of me. But it's true that at some point, I mean, as you say, there's always some risk in going to Mass. And you think about all the different Christians throughout history that have suffered for the sake of the Holy Eucharist, not only, you know, the Black Death and the Spanish flu, but what about the Jesuits that went to Elizabethan England and Japan and ministered to the underground church there, or the underground church in Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union? The logic really has to be the same. How do we not say the risk to their health was so great that they would have been better off not going to Mass? Why couldn't the bishops just say, you know, for the rest of your life until the fall of the Iron Curtain, you're dispensed from your Sunday obligation. Don't worry about it. We don't want anything bad to happen to you. What's the difference? Except for the fact that the coronavirus is far less deadly than the Gestapo or the NKVD.
Let me sound a somewhat cheerier note. There's a flip side to this, I think. And that is that people like myself, and probably like you and many of the people who will hear us, have noticed that the priests, the pastors who made a special effort to administer the sacraments. I certainly noticed, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but there were priests who pushed the envelope. There were priests who did whatever they could within the regulations that were given to them by their bishops. There were priests who made it very clear that they were pained by the fact that they could not celebrate Mass for us, that they could not give us communion, and who, as soon as there was an opening, jumped at it. And when I say that a lot of people are detached from parishes, I think that the good news is they're going to be headed for the parishes where they found that attitude during this lockdown, where they found the priests who are celebrating Mass in parking lots and hearing confessions in open fields and so forth. You notice the priests who are doing their job and you gravitate towards them. While I think that we'll lose a lot of numbers as a result of this lockdown, I think that we may find an increased intensity in those communities that do survive and thrive.
That's a terrific point. Absolutely. I don't know if I should say, I don't want to be too hard on the bishops, but I think what you said about grieving parish priests not to be able to celebrate the Mass for their flock. No one theoretically, hopefully, is ordained to the priesthood looking for excuses to suspend Mass or to not go to Mass. Most priests, I think, even today, most priests want to say Mass. I could be wrong about that. That could be optimistic. But I think an important distinction is that, public ministry in the sense of celebrating Mass for the public is not part of the bishop's job so much as it is the parish priest. I have to wonder if maybe because the bishops are themselves priests, because they're able to celebrate private Masses, because they celebrate Mass frequently with other priests or attend Mass in their chanceries, I have to wonder if they have somehow become so detached that they don't realize that the, what did you call it? You called it a Eucharistic famine. I wonder if they didn't realize how much this was going to impact the faithful.
Right. I wonder that too. And I appreciate people. I mean, I'm happy to say my pastor has been one who has been chomping at the bit and very anxious to open up as much as he can open up. And you talk to him for about 2 seconds before you realize how frustrated and sad he has been about this. And that sparks your faith because you recognize that he has a priestly heart and you recognize how important the Eucharist is to him. And we all need to reaffirm each other in that.
Absolutely. And there was a priest who... well-meaning, but I think grievously, grievously wrong. He's one of these celebrity priests, I think, who tours and gives talks and stuff like that. And he said basically, we should never reinstate the Sunday obligation. The bishop should suspend the Sunday obligation indefinitely, because that will separate those who want to be at Mass from those who don't want to be at Mass, and those who don't want to be who only go to Mass because they. Because they're, I don't know what he would say, legalistic, ritualistic, whatever. We don't need them. We don't want them to come. We only want the people that, want to be there. I think that that's very, very, very wrong. But it does make an important point, which is that, back in the 90s, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict gave that famous interview about how the church was going to return to a mustard seed phase, where a lot, it was going to get smaller, but it was in in the process of shrinking, in the process of losing sort of its political, social, cultural cachet, it was going to become more devoted to the gospel, and it was going to become more a missionary church. And I've always, not even more than in a sort of a silver lining sort of way, I've always loved that image, because you do look at the church today and you see, you know, bishops that are sitting on millions and millions and millions of dollars of worth of property, assets, things like that, but who can't put butts in pews. And you'd think to yourself, and of course, these bishops are having to administer these. I don't want to give the bishops more or less credit than they're due, but it's a necessity these days that bishops just have so much infrastructure to administer to, that they can't do their jobs, which is to be the pastor, the shepherds of their flock, and to teach the faithful. And so this idea that the church is going to shrink and to become, I don't want to say purer, but it's going to get to the point where, you know, it has the missionary zeal that it needs we don't have any illusions about the fact that we're a major force in the culture, because we're not. If we get to that mustard seed phase, well, what does a seed do? It flowers. And so once we get back to the seed phase, maybe we'll see a new flowering in the church. And maybe what the coronavirus will do, as you said, is to sort of, it'll draw people to those parishes that already have that missionary zeal, that aren't complacent, that aren't sitting back and just sort of trying to maintain the decline, that are going to fight to win souls and to take back the culture for the church, instead of pretending that all we have to do is sort of fiddle with a couple of knobs and we'll remain part of the quote unquote establishment.
Yeah, well, I have always thought that then Cardinal Ratzinger was being prophetic when he talked about the creative minority that the church of the future will be. Prophetic, but it's a prophecy, but it's not a desirable one, or it's not entirely desirable. It's certainly desirable that we'd be more evangelical and more creative and more of a force in the culture and more of an impetus to build up the kingdom. That's all good. The fact that we'd be smaller is not good. And this is something that troubles me, and it troubles me when I hear people like the priest you cited talking about, basically saying, oh, these people who are sort of lukewarm, who aren't very much committed to the faith, let's just cast them adrift. There are variations on that theme. People who think that, oh, the church is, there's only a very small minority, there's only a remnant, and so let's get down to that remnant and then we'll all be in business. Well, what about the good people who are clinging to the faith with problems, with their own share of, you know, sinful nature, which we all have, and they're trying to get by, they're trying to be better. I'm not ready to write them all off, and that's why I say it's a potential catastrophe if we lose these people, because, you know, going to church on Sunday isn't just obeying a precept of the church, it's obeying the first commandment. It's a duty in justice, as St. Thomas Aquinas would say. You know, we have a duty in justice to worship, and this is the perfect rational worship. And we should be, you know, to say, oh, you don't have to do it is to send the wrong message. I mean, why aren't you doing it more often?
Absolutely. Personally, I need the Sunday obligation sometimes myself. I mean, maybe 90% of the time, 95% of the time, 99% of the time, I want to go to Mass, even if it's hard to get up in the morning, I want to go to Mass. But sometimes no matter how pious and faithful they are, and I'm by no means pious or faithful in any extraordinary way, but at some point we all need that. We all need it to be an obligation. At some point, you know, we don't have perfect wills to always do what's good. And exactly. I was thinking there's an article that I've always wanted to write. It would be called something like In Defense of Cultural Catholics or something. Because I think what's extraordinary about the Catholic faith is that we have, there is such a thing as a cultural Catholic in a way that there's really not such a thing as a cultural Protestant or a cultural, I don't know, you know, just go through the list. And it's in sort of a, in a similar way that you have a non-practicing Jew or a non-observant Jew, because there are all these tangible things that go with the faith that even people who sort of, whose supernatural faith is weakened, they can still sort of cling to it. Like people who have a statue of the, of Our Lady in their living rooms because, you know, their grandmother did, or people who hang a rosary from their rearview mirror. You know, that's not the, the sum total of the faith, but thank God it's, you know, those tangible things are there for people to, people to hold on to. You know, Catholicism is sort of a sacramental incarnational faith. And it's, and those sacrament, those sacramentals, and are part of the reason that they exist is because, you know, we're not capable of always sustaining this, you know, this brilliant fire, not all of us anyway, right, this brilliant fire of faith in our hearts all the time. Sometimes, you know, I need to look over on my desk and see the crucifix and remember that, you know, Jesus Christ died for my sins, because it's not something that I can just keep on the forefront of my mind all the time, much as I wish I could. So I agree with you 100%. Yeah, I hope I didn't mean to say that, you know, I'm looking forward to the mustard seed phase. No. But, yeah.
It's a great challenge. You know, it's easy for us. We're laymen. We can hide behind microphones. But if you think about the job of a pastor, is really difficult because I'm reminded Pope John the 23rd said that I have to be the Pope for those who have the foot on the brake and those who have the foot on the gas. Mm-hmm. You know, the pastor has to be the pastor for everybody. There are probably people in a typical parish who are wonderfully devout and pious and on fire with love of the Lord and wouldn't miss Mass any day if it killed them. And then there are people who are struggling to get by and might come and might not come. And the pastor's job is to bring all of them closer, where, you know, no matter where they are on the road now, he has to get them closer. Some of them are pretty close and some of them are far away, and he has to deal with all of them. And I suppose it's our job too, even if we're not pastors, to try to be helpful to people. You know, make the holy people, make the saints a little bit holier and the sinners a little less sinful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's why, you know, there's obedience is a virtue. And I hope that you and I will always be obedient to our lawful pastors, the bishops, the Pope, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a point at which, you know, the faithful we have our role to play. And as Archbishop Sheen said, you know, our job as laymen is to help our pastors become better pastors and our bishops to be better bishops. And so this is why I think it is so crucial that we respectfully but firmly say, you know, this is your call, Your Excellency. If you say that I don't have to be at Mass on Sunday, I don't have to be at Mass on Sunday. It's not going to affect my soul. But I think this was a bad call. I think this was demonstrably a bad call.
Right.
And, again, I think there's this huge gulf between the bishops and the laity, where the bishops are, many of them, I think of, you know, Cardinal O'Malley, who clearly really just wants to be a Capuchin friar, and he's such a holy man, and he's doing such good work for the church. But, you know, even these bishops that really want to be with the people, they're stuck being administrators, and I think that gulf between the bishops and the laity is in the way that a lot of these, you know, chancery bureaucrats wheedle their way in between the shepherd and the flock. I mean, I think that is one of the taproots of the crisis in the church today.
Yeah. I just add one thing to what you said. If the bishop tells me I don't have to be at Mass on Sunday, which he has told me, then I can say, and I have said, I think it's a bad call. But I accept his authority. There's no question he has authority to issue that dispensation. But another thing I have to tell him is I will be at Mass on Sunday. I don't have to be, but I will be because I want to be.
100%. Yeah, and I think to that point, I mean, I still cannot believe that Archbishop Wilton Gregory of Washington, D.C. put out that statement saying that he was suspending public masses because the health of his parishioners is his number one priority. I have to believe, as I wrote my column responding to that statement, I really have to believe that he did write it, that one of his divorcees who work in in parish offices or chancery offices wrote that for him, because that is just that is, those are not the words of a successor to the apostles. It couldn't have possibly come from his mouth, or it was an invidious, a very evil thing to say, and it was because it was so obviously counter to what his mission is, it was kind of like a slap in the face. It was, right. Let me see how far I can push the boundaries. So in charity, I have to assume that he didn't write it, but that is the perfect example, I think, of bishops and diocesan officials just succumbing to the worst kind of bureaucratic legalese, where literally they think of themselves as institutions sort of providing a service to the public, and like any other corporation or legal entity, they're obligated to put out a statement saying, you know, the health and well-being of our customers is our number one priority. Therefore, we have implemented the following restrictions. And then, you know, it's just hideous. It's a hideous noise to hear coming out of the mouth of the bishop. So, yeah, I agree entirely. That is... Someone, I don't know, upstairs or downstairs, someone was making it very clear that that is not a directive that anyone is morally obligated to follow, in my opinion. So, I don't know, Phil, what do you think?
Well, I agree with you that if an archbishop says the spiritual welfare of my people is my highest priority, then I'm with him. If he says the health of my people, meaning physical health, then that's simply wrong. That's wrong. It's not his top priority, and if he thinks it is, we have a problem on our hands. And I'm not going to mince words about that. That's just plain wrong. But an ancillary problem that we've had here is, I think, bishops paying a whole lot of attention to what public health officials are saying. And that's legitimate, of course. Public health officials are supposed to be in charge of telling you what is beneficial or detrimental to the public health. But we're in a situation now where I'm sure you're like me, you read lots of things, sometimes obsessively. And when there's an issue like this, I've read so much in the last 90 days about the coronavirus and about the risks and so forth. And almost everything that I read that purports to be scientific is promptly contradicted by someone else who purports to be a scientist. So I've reached the conclusion that the data are very clear on one thing. The data are very clear in showing me that the experts don't know enough about this disease to make sound public policy recommendations. And therefore we're on our own. We have to read what we can, learn what we can, and then make our own prudent decisions about how much we want to do to protect ourselves and others.
It wasn't only the quote unquote experts that were pretending that they knew what they were talking about, but it was journalists. I mean, and as a journalist, I mean, just can you imagine taking to the internet, like the new you or me, going on the New York Times and thinking to yourself, oh, I have a great berth of scientific expertise. I'm going to tell millions of people how they should be responding to this global pandemic. It's just insane. So, I mean, people have to be very, very discerning with what they read on the internet and even in mainstream, you know, formerly respectable news sources like the Washington Post, because there's just so much nonsense being peddled around. And I guess this is kind of a neat segue into the sort of the more secular side of the coronavirus pandemic. But I mean, What are we supposed to do? We were talking before the show started, and Phil, you know, lives in Massachusetts. I live in New Hampshire. And I mean, I walk around, I wear a mask when I go to Target because it's Target policy, but you know, I walk around and no one's wearing masks here. And that's, and this is, you know, I guess it's live free or die in New Hampshire, but people just don't seem to be taking it seriously. And then you have these, you know, these, on the one hand, there were obviously, you know, something like 1 million deaths in the United States from the pandemic, more than that. But then you also have these very strange occurrences, like in Sweden, the very low rate of, despite the fact that Sweden took no precautions, there's been a very low spread of the disease. And then Liberty University just reopened their campus for graduation, and there wasn't a mass outbreak at Liberty University either. So this really is just, I mean, we're kind of just shooting in the dark here, aren't we? We have no idea what's going on.
We don't know very much at all about what's going on. We do know a few things that, for instance, New York City was a hotspot. And if I lived in New York, I would have taken more precautions than I'm taking where I am. There was a point at which I read something telling me that anytime I went outside, I should be wearing a mask. Well, you've been to my house and you know that I can go outside and I can walk for 5 miles and no one will see me. Right. So there's no possibility that another human being will communicate this disease to me. You know, I'm more worried about deer ticks.
Right.
And I mean, I say that as a joke, but it's not a joke. If you live where I live, you worry about deer ticks. It's rational. You take precautions. You don't worry as much about the coronavirus as you would if you're in New York, because it's a different ball game. And we know sort of which precautions to take. And the CDC really doesn't have to send out bulletins. You know, I'm not sharing lollipops with anybody these days. On the other hand, I'm not afraid of my own family. There's just a sense of proportion that people panic, let's face it. And the media has fed that panic because bad news sells. I have been frustrated beyond belief by the newspapers, which every day have a frightening headline saying the number of coronavirus cases has gone up. Well, of course it's gone up. It's not going to go down.
I was in Mecosta, Michigan recently. My wife and I were staying at the Russell Kirk Center for we were supposed to be there for a weekend. We ended up being there for a couple of months because of the lockdown in Michigan. But we were, I think in Mecosta County, I think there, when we left, there were 13 cases of coronavirus in the whole county. And this is not terrible. This is not only a couple hours drive from Detroit, which is one of probably the second largest center of coronavirus in the country. And, yeah, I remember I was reading all of these articles in things like the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Washington Post, LA, etc., saying, you know, all you stupid country hayseeds that aren't wearing your masks, don't think that you're immune. It's going to get really bad in the country. And it didn't. It just never did. You know, and I think I have a feeling that a lot of that was motivated by because the media class has been repeated ad infinitum, is concentrated in New York and DC and LA. And I think that, you know, their reporting reflected that, because it was terrible in New York, but there was no rational assessment of the fact that it actually wasn't really that bad in places like Mecosta, which is relatively sparsely populated, but where I never saw a single person wearing a face mask. Or, you know, that's just the way it is out there. So yeah, I mean, I think that this was a really extraordinary lesson in how the sort of the unconscious biases of the media were reflected in reporting, and also how we talk about them, you know, the media is becoming sort of a secular priesthood. They've become the arbiters of truth for a society that no longer has any sort of real religion, and they have failed spectacularly in their duty this time, I think, in many, many different regards.
They have, to give them a little bit of an out, not that they deserve it, they've failed partly because if you're a good journalist in a time like this, you look to the official government sources as your sort of go-to providers of information. And the official government sources have been all over the place. Actually, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with a reporter saying that, saying, gee, dear readers, the government's been all over the place on this.
You know what's frightening, Phil, is I'm thinking, is that if you think about it, the person that probably knows more about coronavirus actually in a practical way than anyone else on the planet is probably Donald Trump. I mean, I'm sure there are scientists that know more about the virology and things like that, but who's being briefed more than anyone on the planet about the spread and about the nature of coronavirus than Donald?
Well, he's being briefed more, but is that good or bad?
I am making no judgment whatsoever.
I'm just saying this. Briefings, you know, the briefings that you get, I think, would just confuse you. There's a point at which you throw up your hands and you stay away, scientists.
Well, you'd hope so. And that is an important lesson, I think, in a humility that modern man also sort of lacks, where we think that our scientific knowledge is infinite and that all the natural forces basically dance at our fingertips. And the fact that we have this contagion that has been, the outbreak has been sustained and really has, I don't want to minimize the threat of it, has been quite devastating. And the fact that we just still know so little about it, it has to shake our faith in the sort of the secular materialist scientism that is that prevails in our culture, because the war, as I wrote in one of my columns for the American Conservative, I mean, you can think of any crackpot theory you want about the nature of coronavirus. There's an academic at the smallest branch of some state university who will back it up, who you can quote as your expert source. There's an expert source for anything you want these days.
Right.
That really is something that we have to take before, not just because we need to make good rational decisions about politics or whatever, but because we need to be able to control our own emotions. And I think that you read the statistics about skyrocketing alcohol abuse, skyrocketing domestic abuse, suicide hotlines that are being flooded with calls from people who are despairing because the media is telling them to despair.
Yeah.
And who are absolutely convinced that if they go outside, they're going to kill 400 old ladies and 300 World War II veterans and 7 puppies. We lack a sort of a emotional self-discipline that the media really has been agitating.
Here's another way that I'd turn that around, and I think it's something that the church can and should do, and that is, yes, this is a very bad disease. This has been devastating. We are losing people we love. And others are fearful, and for some people, it's perfectly rational to be fearful if you're vulnerable. And it makes you ask yourself, who's in control here? And the correct answer is not me. And you realize, well, yes, eventually I will die. That is beyond my power to control. And you start asking yourself the ultimate questions. What is the purpose of my life? Is there anything that I will die for? And these are questions that a comfortable consumer society sort of discourages us from asking, and a healthy church encourages us.
When they were closing down the churches, you look at the institutions that were allowed to stay open, like alcohol stores and pot dispensaries and sex shops. You look at all the pornography sites that were offering free memberships, and it was perfectly clear that what our society values at that point, because we were not allowed to turn to God for comfort. We were allowed to turn to drugs and sort of other sedatives to sort of assuage our fear of death. We weren't allowed to confront our fear of death, and we weren't allowed to look to some sort of hereafter. And that was, again, that seemed very, very telling to me, that in times of trial, the assumption was that we were not going to turn to God. We were going to turn to substances, different kinds of substances and, right, and creature comforts. And, you know, this must be the first time in the history of Western civilization that that has been the case.
Well, yeah. And that is why I do believe firmly that this is what they call a teachable moment for the church, because you realize, if you're at all rational, that these various sedatives are illusory. And you realize, if you have any true self-consciousness, that we do have to answer those ultimate questions. And that's, you know, that's the business of the church, asking and answering those ultimate questions.
Now, you asked who's in control here, and we are not in control of the coronavirus, but we can be in control of our children's education. And I'm going to pivot to our other topic for today, which is homeschooling. And we were all treated to that magnificent article in Harvard Magazine called "The Risks of Homeschooling" in the May-June issue, which said that homeschooling as a concept, and didn't even look like it was written as a response to the coronavirus. It looked like it was just some insane rambling. That the concept of homeschooling is dangerous and authoritarian. Those are two quotes: dangerous and authoritarian, because it denies children the right to a, quote, meaningful and democratic education. I really liked the article, because it seemed to prove once and for all, this was sort of the, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain stuff. We now have the advocates of public education saying to us, the point of public schools is not to give your child a good education. Let's dispense with that lie now once and for all. We're not saying that your son needs a good education. We're saying that he needs a meaningful education, a democratic education. He needs to be taught to be a good citizen. That is obviously extremely creepy, but also extremely illuminating. And I'm sure that you, Phil, have also, as a homeschool father, I'm sure that you have also been heartened by the statistics that say things like 40% of parents are interested in homeschooling their children going forward. Whereas Amy Fahey, our mutual friend, wrote a terrific article for Crisis talking about this statistic, how, you know, the media again is just flooding us with these memes and these anecdotes about mothers that are just so overwhelmed by having to actually be around their own children, and how miserable they are because they don't have a public school teacher or a nanny to pawn their brood off on. And so again, the media is patently anti-parenting, anti-homeschool, wants to encourage parents to think of their children as a burden. But more parents are inclined now to homeschool than are less inclined than when going into this. Homeschooling is now more popular than it was before. Come to find, a lot of parents like being around their own children. And what better way than homeschooling?
Right. Well, that article in Harvard Magazine that you cite, the quotation that I found most frightening was the one where Professor Dwyer said something about how children, I forget how he phrased it, essentially he was saying children don't belong to the parents, they belong to the state. That was the thrust of what he was saying. The state should decide what children do, not the parents, which is a direct assault on the family. And yes, it is interesting now, when families are thrust together, many of them unwillingly, they find in many cases, thank God, they like each other. They enjoy being around. That's one thing they find. The other thing they find is that they can learn from each other, that the children can learn at the instruction of the parents, and they might well find that actually they're not learning a whole lot in school. And you know, if you see that Harvard Magazine article, it has an illustration in it that fascinates me. The illustration is of a bunch of little children inside a building, looking out as if they're looking through the bars of prison cells. And these are the homeschoolers. And outside are a bunch of kids dancing around having fun. And these are presumably the kids in public schools. Now, if you just think about it, that is image is absolutely upside down. Because
exactly.
Homeschool kids are spending their days out in the fields and doing their math on their own time, maybe when it's raining.
Yeah.
Whereas the kids in public schools are in these buildings that very often do look suspiciously like prisons. And they're unable to. I remember when I was in school, most of the time I dreamt about getting out. it's interesting. Now, Amy Fahey makes the point too that what parents are doing now, most parents, is not homeschooling. It's being teacher's aides. But those who are finding themselves interested in homeschooling are getting more so. And, you know, if what I've heard about the reopening of schools, if the reopening of schools looks anything like the way it's been portrayed in the media recently, where every child has to be in a cubicle and with a mask and not touching any other child, that's inhuman. I mean, I hope a whole lot of parents will rebel at that and say, no, I'm not sending my child into that prison-like atmosphere. I can keep him home. Now, it will be difficult. But I think that this, we talked about the implications of this pandemic and the lockdown for the church and for the family. There are also its implications. And I think we will see a boom in homeschooling, which is booming anyway. Was booming before this happened. I'm in the unaccustomed position of trying to give good news today. That's contrary to my reputation, but
as
you well know, and I want to get this in while we still have a little time. As you well know, the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture had a virtual conference on homeschooling in answer to the Harvard Magazine article. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture. And you can see we had some great speakers led by Robert George and Douglas Farrow. But the final speaker was Jamie Gass from the Pioneer Institute talking about the Espinoza decision, which is pending. It's going to come down from the Supreme Court literally any day now. I guess it will probably be in June, but it could be today. The Espinoza decision could be a real breakthrough for school choice. It could open the door to all sorts of things, maybe not directly to homeschooling, but to all sorts of private schools, hybrid schools, parochial schools, charter schools. If the Supreme Court does what my lawyer friends think it's going to do, we will have a much brighter horizon for parents who want control over their children's education.
Absolutely. And I think, I'll put the link to the conference in the YouTube description and anywhere else I can, because this is absolutely something that that our readers should be checking out. But I think to make a simpler point and to sort of, you know, the answer isn't necessarily some sort of mass redistribution of wealth, because on average across the United States, every public school student costs about $14,000 to babysit and then occasionally to be forced to read a book like Where the Red Fern Grows. That $14,000 per student comes from somewhere. It comes from the taxpayers. And so this is, laissez-faire or not, the cutting government waste is a really easy way to begin giving parents the right to educate their own children. And as you're talking about, I mean, a lot of school choice bills say that, you know, not only do you have the right to send your child to the institution that you want, but you sort of have the right to to move that money around. You don't have to pay into the public school system. You can use that money for something else. And I think that that's a terrific way to begin.
Yes, it certainly is. It's, well, anything that works for educational choice is a step in the right direction. Anything that helps parents and other taxpayers recognize that we're in an unsustainable situation. You know, we can't keep spending more for less education, and that's what we've been doing now for a generation. And to take control of it, one of my hopes about this crisis that we've been through and that we've been discussing is that when we come out of it, and people talk about the new normal, my hope is the new normal will be will place more emphasis on taking care of your own problems yourself, on personal accountability, and on local control and parental control.
And I think of, I also went through a traditional school education. I went to public school for the first half of my life, and then Catholic school for the second half. And I'm thinking about that illustration that went on the article with the homeschool children sort of locked behind bars and all the public school children going outside to play. At my schools, we had a big slab of asphalt that would double as a parking lot for school events. And we were allowed to play with koosh balls, which are these like hideous stringy rubber balls. And that was it. And we were surrounded by this chain link fence, and there were always teachers roving around to make sure that we didn't get into fights, or that, you know, pedophiles didn't walk up and swoop us out of the playground. And that was like, that was recess to us. That was what we really looked forward to. And then I've converted to Catholicism, and I've sort of gotten involved with our community, I've seen kids, homeschool kids, for whom recess means going outside and playing in their yard and riding bikes with their brothers and sisters, skipping rope, or playing flag football with their fellow co-op students. And it's just, even if there was no difference in the quality of the education, if that was the only thing that my children got, was the opportunity to get real exercise with their real friends, you know, outside in fresh air, on grass, climbing trees, doing things, you know, not with the scientifically approved balls, playing the scientifically approved games that are calculated to minimize, you know, any potential hurt feelings or injuries. They're actually doing little boys and little girls stuff. That would be a reason. That's one reason that I will never, ever send my kids to public school, ever.
Yeah, well, I never went to a public school, but even parochial schools, well, school is problematical, let's face it. It's great fun to be able to do things on your own time. And you know, when you leave school, I remember leaving graduate school, and one of the great realizations was, now I can read what I want when I want. I don't have to read a book for tomorrow's class. And there's one book that went on the shelf and has never come off it. And there are a whole lot of books that came off the shelf, and I inhaled them. Mm-hmm. And my grandchildren, who are homeschooling now, are mostly in that category. They go through books like wildfire because they want to. And it's a little bit like a smaller child. You know, you want the little two-year-old to eat his peas. And some nights he's just not going to eat his peas. And then comes a time he wants nothing but peas. And it's a little like that homeschooling. It works out if you're reasonably prudent about it. It works out. And the parents know the child and know when to push. And it's just a nice system, not only for education, but also for the family.
I liked the book. I was an English major, and I really wasn't good in any other subject in school, so I'm going to run with that one. But it's when you have these, again, these scientifically calculated curricula that are guaranteed not to offend anyone and things like that, what you wind up with is an almost total absence of good classic literature and a superabundance of generic nonsense like Where the Red Fern Grows and The Giver and Rolling Thunder, Hear My Cry, things that children would never, ever read of their own volition, but in which are, you know, kind of like America Magazine, the only reason that they're in business is because the Jesuit schools buy subscriptions. In the same way, you know, these books just wouldn't exist if every single public school in the country forced their children to read it. And that we it's like this parallel literary tradition where there's the books that everyone has pretty much been forced to read and pretty much everyone also hates. And really great books that, you know, kids actually would really like if they were allowed to read them, which are the great books of Western civilization. And yet we don't let them read it. And it's baffling. But again, just yes, absolutely. You can always find, if you don't go by this scientifically formulated, government approved curriculum, and if you sort of work with your child to discover what kind of books they like, I mean, some will like Shakespeare, some will like Homer. Every little boy loves Edgar Allan Poe. There's always going to be Poe. You know, that it's so much richer. And if you want to instill a love of learning in a child, if you really want them to learn how to learn to love reading, then find them books that they're going to love reading. Don't make them read these generic sort of computer generated young adults lits that, again, just it's a miracle that I have any love of reading at all, because that was what I was raised on.
It is too bad. Yeah, we have lots of work to do on that score.
We do, but I think that we'll have to save it for next week. This has been really, really terrific, Phil, and I'm really glad that we're finally doing this. And I thank all of you for listening. I hope that you'll join us again next Friday. This is Michael Warren Davis and Phil Lawler with the Crisis Point Podcast. Until next week, thank you all very much for tuning in, and God bless you.